Welcome to In Conversation With from Devon Chamber, supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Recorded at Fresh Air Studios in Plymouth.
Are you sitting comfortably?
I am.
Then we begin. Hello and welcome to In Conversation With, the podcast series from the Devon Chamber of Commerce. My name is Paul Philpott and I'm your host, but breaking news, I'm not going to be your host for that much longer. Now, I suppose you could say, because of when we're recording this, and hopefully when you're listening to this, that this is a Christmas special. So wearing a festive red dress sat next to me is, drumroll please, the new CEO of the Devon Chamber of Commerce, Helen Wild Archibald. That is a nice festive colour, I think.
Thank you, yes.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
And I'll soon be saying welcome to the chair because you're going to be taking over from me.
I am. It's a bit scary, isn't it?
I hope you know what you're letting yourself in for. Now, you're new in post. Let's find out a bit about the new CEO. Born and bred in the Southwest, and you spent much of your career travelling and working internationally, which sounds very interesting.
Yes.
So you're from here, but you've ventured further afield. You came back to Devon in 2019. You've now landed the role as CEO of the Devon Chamber. Mm-hmm. I'll start with that first. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How does it feel?
It feels great, actually. Everyone's been so kind and so welcoming, and it's just a lovely bunch of people to work with. So what's not to like? And we're doing something useful and important. So it's great. Really enjoying it.
Brilliant. Good. Well, there's no turning back now. Put it out.
No.
You signed on the dotted line.
I did.
So tell us about your early career then. So where did Helen start out in the world of business?
I went off to university and I really thought that I was going to have an academic career. I thought I was going to become an archaeologist and a lecturer. And I was all lined up to do that. And when I was doing my second degree, I sort of was funding myself by working locally. I went to Keele University. I was working in Stoke. And the company I was working for had just bought PCs for the first time and an IT system. They didn't know how to put it in. So I put it in for them because I've grown up with PCs in IT and I know how to do that. And during the course of that, I just found I had a head for business, which I didn't realise I had. And actually, I knew how to make the things work. I knew how to make business work. I knew how to get systems working, get people working. And they offered me an internship on the back of it, and I never looked back. So that's how I ended up coming into business in the first place. And from there, I just got really lucky. I got picked up by Vodafone. I think I was number 53 through the door when it was still very much in the top of a Chinese takeaway in the middle of Newbury, and everyone sat around one desk and smoked, which is the other thing we're course we stopped doing nowadays.
Yeah, thankfully.
But that gave me exposure to all the top brass and everything, and they were really kind to me and they really trained me up and showed me what I needed to do. So I was just very, very lucky. I fell on my feet at the right time, right place in both occasions. And after that, there was no question of me digging holes and being an archaeologist. That was off and that's what I was going to do instead.
Quite interesting. Your initial outset was to be an archaeologist and then you end up dealing with, I guess now we call it ancient tech.
Yeah.
Why the shift?
I think what I realised was that the stuff that I was researching and everything was all very well. But what they don't tell you about archaeology is you're either very cold and wet or sunburnt, and you spend most of your time with your backside in the air with a lot of people looking at it.
Just got an image now.
Yeah, it's not flattering. And you never have decent nails in your life because you're constantly scrapping around in the dirt. And whilst it's fascinating, it is actually physically really, really hard work. Mm. And you can dig for days and days and days and find nothing. You can go to a site and it looks like when you've done the geophysics, there's going to be something marvellous. The moment you put a spade in there's nothing there. So it's not like doing the crossword at the weekend. You could end up with a completely blank grid and come out with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, it was still also completely male-dominated. This is before Mary Beard and everybody else got involved.
Yeah, and so many industries were.
Yeah, absolutely. And you normally slept in a tent on the site somewhere, and that could be anywhere. So that could be ancient Greece, ancient Rome that you were looking at, Turkey. And these are not places you really want to sleep in a tent in when you're 21. So the whole thing was a little bit wild. And whilst I probably would have enjoyed it, it wasn't the career I wanted. And it wasn't actually as exciting as I thought it was going to be.
But did you find that there are some transferable skills? Obviously, one could argue that being out in the middle of nowhere, staying in a tent is probably quite well transferable to working in the Southwest. How did you apply those skills that you learned in archaeology to business? Were there things you could take with you?
Yeah, because it was data. So one of the reasons I'd picked that is that I've got a skill with linguistics. And part of my degree course I'd learned to do...
It's easy for you to say.
Yeah. I got to do ancient Greek and Latin and all these types of different languages. And that's no different, really. Those communication skills are really, really useful. You had to be quite highly organised when you do ancient languages mm-hmm. because they don't work in the same way as modern languages do. And it's a bit like programming computers in a strange sort of way. So I think the linguistic side of it really helped in terms of communication skills and also data analysis. And you have to be really, really well organised when you're dealing with big sections of data where half of it's missing. You can get to the third page in a book and the rest of the book's missing and you're translating away and it's like, well, that was interesting. Where's the rest of it? Or you get half an artifact. Where's the other half? So you have to use the data to work it through. So I think one side, data and communications, and on the other side, just having the vision. Because when you are working in those environments, what you find is quite often you've got half a story. So you've got to work out with the facts you've got and a bit of imagination what the rest of the story might have been. What's the alternative narrative here? Mm. How do those things work? And that's the really interesting bit. And if you think about business, everything is like that. You get half the story, half the information, half the opportunity, and then you need to visualize how you're going to get through it to the other side. So I think ultimately those are the things that I took forward from what I'd done early on.
I've already got a catchphrase for you, actually.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
I've been in quite a few meetings with you already, and there's one thing that you end up saying, and that's, well, I've done the research and... You can hear yourself saying that now, can't you?
Yeah.
I guess that's a carry-on from everything you've just said.
Yes, it is. I really enjoy that side of things. I really enjoy understanding facts and data and retaining it and sorting it out and making it into some sort of order. So yeah, I think that's probably where it all comes from originally.
Yeah. So when you're at Vodafone then, you'll break into business. Mobile phones were the size of bricks.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and we all remember those days, some of us quite fondly. And then you went on to O2. Did Vodafone become O2 when you were there? Or
no, they set up, so BT basically had to change their licensing terms and set up a mobile network separately, which is O2. And I went to join them and they were setting up. Because by that time, Vodafone was absolutely huge and we'd been rolling out globally for some time. O2 was quite an interesting company because it was very focused on customer experience. And I was very interested in that and how you brought that together. Mm. But technically, if you want to know how to build anything, Vodafone are your people to do that. They know how to build stuff.
And then you got involved in transport.
Yes.
Going places in a different kind of way or enabling others to be able to go places. Tell us a bit about that.
So first of all, I went to work for Parcelforce and the Royal Mail.
Yeah.
And I basically that was to put in the IT systems. So all the systems you have now, which basically tell you when your parcel's going to arrive, we had to write those. Now, this is an area of business which sadly doesn't necessarily lead on tech. So it was going to be quite a battle in order for us to get the systems and processes working to make that work, not least because the CRM system was in someone's roof. So on my day one, I went and collected it out of their attic and brought it into the office. And actually the whole of the server was basically a broom cupboard downstairs with a mop bucket opening up and so it didn't overheat.
I've heard this story about so many businesses.
It was hilarious. But then again, the thing about Royal Mail and Parcelforce, they're really nice people. And people really think they're doing something important, delivering the mail and parcels and things. And the teams are lovely. And they wanted to do it. So we actually got a huge amount of investment for a massive new system, which was great, which included an aerial sortation system, which is still the best in Europe today. And the project was really exciting and, you know, a real opportunity to sort of make customer experience better. So I did that for them, which was really good fun. And I learned an awful lot about parcels and what can go wrong, which is enormous amounts. As soon as you get into logistics, everything can go wrong.
Yeah.
There's too many moving parts. But a bit later on in my career, I then went off to work for the Catapults, which is a quasi sort of government body, part of IUK. And I worked for the Transport Systems Catapult and Connected Cities Catapults. And I worked on connecting autonomous vehicles. So in Milton Keynes, the way that works is you can actually put them on the road there because the way the council owns the red routes. We did stuff on robotics, the robotic deliveries. We did things on the future of flight. Hydrogen is a potential fuel alternative and lots of stuff on drones, which actually people didn't realise, but 10, 15 years ago, a drone this size was a rarity.
Yeah.
But actually, we'd already got them. And they were absolutely tiny. And, you know, so on one side, we're working on a tiny little thing like that, a spy drone. And on the other side, we were working out in Singapore on the first unmanned taxis, air taxis, which I took a flight in. It was terrifying, to be perfectly honest. The interesting thing about that was it was all about human factors. So we get the technology to work, no problem. But when you have something which isn't connected to a human being, you have an ethics issue.
Hmm.
So what do you do? So if you're coming up to a crossing and there's two people on the crossing, but you own the vehicle, does the vehicle kill you or the two people on the crossing?
Yes. There's the shopping trolley and the person with the pram analogy, isn't there?
It is.
With automation and robotic.
Exactly.
Vehicles.
Yeah. So, and it's called human factors.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because that was then the discussion globally about how do we work out regulation, ethics, how do you put together the frameworks around this? And then actually it's quite interesting because it was so difficult to do. If you look what's happening in Plymouth now with connecting autonomous vehicles in the water, it makes more sense to start there because actually the requirement for regulation legislation is less. You've got more space to manoeuvre. And in many ways, less things can go wrong than when you're doing it on the roads, particularly when you've got other people driving. So who's going to be at fault, the drivers or the autonomous vehicles?
Yeah. You love tech.
Yeah.
Most of us in the South West will probably know you from your previous role, which is CEO of Wildernet. I always used to think Wildernet, Helen Wild. I thought you were the Wild Wildernet. I thought it was your gig.
Oh, no, it was not.
No,
it
was definitely not.
Definitely not. And I didn't even notice for about 3 months until somebody asked me the question about how much money I put in, and I looked at them and then I realised why they were asking me the question. So basically, the four founders had contacted me and said, Helen, we need some help rolling this out.
Yeah.
Would you like to join us? And I said, yes, I would. Okay. I said, but I'm building a railway, which I was at the time up in the northeast. I've got to finish that job off first for First Group.
That was the Lumo service?
Yeah, the Sustainable Democratised Railway. So I was doing that during lockdown. So I said, I'll come on as a non-exec and then I'll take up the CEO role when I've got my railway launch, which I duly did. And it was one of the most interesting projects I've ever done. And I still hold it very, very dear because Cornwall is very difficult to fibre. One, nothing is in the holes in the ground where they say it is. That's the first thing. So you can dig a hole and there's no pipes there. They're over there instead. The second thing is granite, which is absolute nightmare. You don't want to, as a UNESCO site, necessarily go overhead. Sometimes you're going down cliffs and all sorts of things. So it really was not going to get done without government funding.
Yeah.
So having secured the government funding, we also had some social value requirements and environmental value around that, which made it a really interesting project. So local employment, building our own academy, which I absolutely loved with all the young engineers coming in to be trained, and making sure we're putting back into the community in terms of how we worked. And it was a really happy place. We created a really happy company very, very quickly, and we built out that network. And actually, by the time the Wildernet project completes, which will be in about 2 years' time, basically Cornwall will have 92% coverage. I'm afraid Devon, which we weren't doing, will still have about 70. And that's why you need those sort of projects, and you need the community behind you and everyone behind you so that you can actually do them and roll them out. Three swimming pools of water out of one particular area, I'll never forget that. And we got down to one of the very bottom parts of Cornwall, opened up a whole load of pipes, and it were full of red socks. And the engineer sent me a photograph. I said, what the hell have you been doing? He said, no, this wasn't us, Helen. So we got to the bottom of it. And basically, the locals had real problems with flooding and thought it was the pipes.
Yeah.
So several years before, when the football team had stopped playing, used their old kit and filled the entire pipe full of the old kit.
Like a sewage level size pipe, like 3 or 4 feet across.
Football kit. Bright red football kit.
Okay.
And I was saying, I don't want you to touch that until we've had a health and safety assessment, because if it's been sitting down there, goodness knows what's in it.
Yeah.
It's going to be horrible. So we basically had to unplug all that and then explain to the locals there was going to be no risk of flooding. And actually it wasn't, the pipe was causing the problem. So on a daily basis, there was always some really funny challenge coming up. One particular one, we had to abseil down the cliff to get the service delivered. And this is where you're thankful that a third of your team are ex-forces, because they literally were, right, let's get in there.
Yeah.
Let's go. Because, you know, it's nothing we haven't done in Iraq,
Helen.
Come on,
team, let's...
exactly. Yeah. You might have done it in Iraq, but you haven't done it in Cornwall. Just let's do the health and safety assessment. Yeah. So it was really good fun. And I really enjoyed it. Very, very full on. And probably one of the toughest projects I've ever done. But the network which is down there will last 40 years. It's an XGS PONS network. It'll never have to be dug up again. And we really went to town on it. And I think actually that's always the way. If you're going to do something, do it properly.
There are kind of like two takeaways I've already got from that conversation there. One is, we're very easy as consumers and businesses to say, and we use this phrase a lot, can't you just ... when it comes to especially things like connectivity, not appreciating the intricacies and the complexities of what needs to happen in the background to make it happen. And also, when you mention about coverage of connectivity, every time I see the data with regards to Devon, it seems to be a different figure each time. You're saying like 70%. I saw a report that says, oh, apparently we've got 93%. I don't know where they are. We're living in a world where even still the importance of digital connectivity is undervalued.
Yes. Well, you can't do anything without it. If you think about it, a house without power, that's going to be a very hard live for anyone who's in it. You're going to be literally in a different century, in the 18th century, not even the 20th century. Very shortly, it will be the same if you haven't got broadband coverage. And post the pandemic, it's really important that people can work more flexibly, but also just generally the types of services that you can offer on the back of it. Once you start getting into the detail around AI and things like that, there is probably a lot of home care we can do so people don't have to go into hospital. They can stay longer in their own homes. There's probably educational things we can do. We can probably make them much more secure and also much better for the environment just by monitoring them properly. You can't do any of that unless you've got coverage. So it's absolutely critical that all houses have that and have it at a decent level. It's also if you do have brandwidth hoovers living at home, i.e. under the age of 12 or up to the age of 18, they are going to hoover up most of the bandwidth in the household. So it needs to be a lot. It can't be just a little, because the minute they start streaming, then anything you're trying to do is just not going to happen.
Yes.
Simple as. And you need to design that for a future where people are doing more and more of that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really, really important.
You often talk about bringing stakeholders together, getting mm-hmm. around the table to talk about decisions and solutions, finding common ground. That's not an easy task. So how are you going to actually do that, do you think? And especially when you have to engage with businesses that are under so much pressure nowadays.
The thing about that is to be respectful. So everyone has something to offer. I don't actually think there are very many bad people on the planet. Once you understand what someone's motivation is and what their difficulties are and what you need to do to help them, you can be useful. And it will change as well over time. So also be current. What are the things which are bothering them right now? What's going to take longer to fix? What's short term? And be transparent and honest about what you can and can't do. And a lot of it is putting people together who work well together, and also ones who aren't going to get on, keep them apart. There's no point. Just don't bother going there. But if you can get people around the table and working together, the sum of the parts will always be better. And it's just giving people time and listening. What can you add to that? And it may be that they require nothing than an ear, just someone they can quietly talk to. Or other times it's what do you know that might be able to help them get to the other side of what they're working on at that moment in time. And that is success as well as failure or potential risk. It's opportunity as well. I think it's just as stressful in business to deal with success and opportunity, because you've basically set yourself a bar, or you want something, you can see what it's going to do to you, as it is when you're scraping around going, right, everything's going wrong, what the hell do I do now? And it's all action stations because things aren't working. And the truth of the matter is there isn't a business on the planet which hasn't been at those two extremities. And if they haven't, they are well under par in terms of performance, because actually you need that stretch to really feel where the stanchions are of the goal that you're aiming for, and to understand how far you might be able to go. So I think it's about being really, really tolerant and inclusive. And there's room for everybody. And as a society, we are better when we're diverse. We're better when we mix it up. Everyone has someone to offer. So just listen it out and see how it fits together.
Absolutely. Working in the creative industries, I think every industry could do with a little bit of creativity.
Absolutely,
every now and then,
yeah.
And diversity and a bit more colour in life.
Yeah.
Now, you're very much, I hope you don't mind me, you're quite team Chamber. You're very on board with the concept of Chamber.
Mm.
And I do believe within your previous role, whether you did this as part of the role or under your own steam, you've written reports, you've done investigative journalism, mm-hmm. you've helped steer public policy and some thought leadership pieces for the British Chambers of Commerce at a national level. Why Chamber? What's the appeal so much to you?
Because I think the thing about the Chamber is that you have a structure which allows you to interact independently as business. Actually, most of our interactions are usually through local authority or through specific industry groups. There is a neutrality about the Chamber, which means you can convene. The other thing is as well, after what happened at the CBI, there was a bit of an air gap, and the British Chamber of Commerce walked into that and really made it their own. And that was the point I was working with them. And that was the year before the election. And they set themselves up to make sure that business had a voice. And they got us access to Rachel Reeves. They got us to Grove, to everybody, Johnny Reynolds, the lot, so that we had literally breakfast meetings. And what was interesting for me, I used to go every month up to London. We'd have the debate, which a minister was in. And every time it changed who I was sitting next to, until I sat down between the boss from the Bank of England and on the other side was the bloke who runs one of the top brands in the UK, only because I'd noticed, because I've read his name, because I'd never seen him before, and I realised he had beautiful nails and I didn't. And I sat between these two, and you could see around the table, you know, you had BP turning up. Those were not people who were in the Chamber when CBI was more active. And suddenly the BCC piece was really getting to grips with it. And what it meant was we could feed in the Southwest story. And that quite often gets missed in the economic strategy and industrial strategy. They don't mention tourism and hospitality. We have 30 million visitors down here. You can't not talk about that. That economy is really, really important to who we are in terms of who we are and what we do down here. There wasn't really anything on farming other than DEFRA. Well, we export £1 billion of livestock out of this county to the rest of the UK. We feed the UK £650 million worth of crops every year, right? So if you're not at the table as Devon having a voice, then then people just forget you and they concentrate on the conurbations and think we're all about cream teas. Mm-hmm. We are not about cream teas. We are a living business environment. So it gave me the opportunity to make sure that all the papers were properly populated for things like making sure we got broadband investment for the Southwest, making sure that when they were talking about renewables and power, that the understanding of the power of the sea, what we're capable of doing down here, when they were talking about defence, to remember that the dockyard was important and just bring them to life by providing case study information that would allow us to leave the door open for investment for businesses down here. And that was particularly interesting for us. I was working on Cornwall at the time, so the Cornwall Chamber of Commerce for this piece. It was on critical minerals. And we have got a major issue coming up with critical minerals. And yet, actually, it looks like we've got lithium in Cornwall. And that could be just so important for the British economy, so important for IT, so important for our futures. Not talking about that in an election year and making sure that Cornish lithium was being heard would have been absolutely ridiculous. And Mike King, very, very vocal, make sure he's campaigning all the time around that. But we could help that with the Chamber of Commerce as well and make sure it was in the papers, all the opportunities that exist down here, so that actually if there was any chance of funding or direction, then we'd get a mention. So that's why I did it, because I think we just need to make sure we've got a voice, really.
Also, I guess you have the opportunity to be a fixer. Mm-hmm. I've kind of got you down as being a bit of a fixer. Given a challenge, you'll run with it and try and do your best to put it right. There are a lot of challenges to small businesses. Mm-hmm. In fact, businesses of all sizes. Yeah. What do you think are the particular challenges that resonate with you?
So I think cash flow in the current environment is much more tricky than it's ever been for small business owners. And unless you're sitting on some sort of funds, it's going to be a daily worry because you've got so much disruption on supply chain at the minute. If you're importing anything globally, The markets are so unstable. The supply lines are unstable. So do you stretch yourself and have more in store? How do you fix your FX? How do you hedge? How do you hedge if you're a small company, full stop? Energy costs are horrendous. For people like advanced manufacturing, it could kill us down here in terms of actually making that work. The cost of labour is extensive. Anybody in business wants to have good people around them and they want to train people and make them successful as part of their product and service. But at the moment, the costs of that are quite high. Mm. And then on top of that, you've got technology creep, things coming in. So, you know, what does AI mean for my business? Can I utilise it? Am I going to get left behind? What do I do? Where does it fit? And I think all in all, with all of the economic and political instability, I can see small businesses working harder and harder because they're worrying about the thinning of returns. And I think it is quite a hard time to make a decent profit. It's one of the lulls where you must have to wait to see if it's going to come back in a few years or change business direction. But if you've invested in something, changing direction normally requires funding. Where does it come from? So I think it's really, really tough in terms of right people, managing your supply chain, managing tech and managing the money right now. Mm. That's something we just all need to be open about because actually there's no point trying to face it out. I don't think there are many businesses who probably aren't looking at that going, crikey, we're earning less than we were last year. I think most businesses are probably in that situation.
I agree. Also, in terms of the recent ride that businesses have had, I think it's also fair to say that there are certain methodologies that are purely dated now, just old hat taxation methodologies, like how they calculate and operate business rates, for example. There's some countries that don't even have that as a concept.
No.
It's part of the corporation tax. If you're not making money, you're not paying the rates.
That's
simple.
It.
And the red tape, every country has its different models when it comes to red tape. But we're particularly fond of red tape.
Oh, here, we certainly
aren't
are.
Aren't we?
Yes.
And it doesn't seem to change from government to government.
No.
It just, everyone puts their own shade of red.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that? Would you want to change anything there?
Yeah, I think the first place I'd want to see change is probably around exports. If you think about where we were pre-Brexit, and this is not a political statement, it's just where we were, the ability for us to actually export was much easier. And we've not really dealt with the paperwork associated with that. And look at the impact it's had on our fishing fleets in places like Brixham. It's become the pelagics are almost gone. We've got no pelagic fishing left down here. But it's just as difficult if you're exporting honey, quite frankly, or exporting candles. It doesn't matter what you're doing, or high-value manufacturing items. It really becomes quite problematic in terms of doing all that paperwork. So that's a big area in the chamber we're focusing on, is getting as much as we can done around making those paperwork systems simple. What can we take out?
Yeah.
How do we help you get your paperwork?
I mean, you use fishing as the example, because fishing is a headline grabber. I mean, you know, we're an island nation, so we tend to be quite fond of the fishing. But you're quite right in saying that once you solve a problem there with regards to paperwork or methods with export, it does cascade to other industries because it sets the precedent, or indeed it changes a system that everybody has to utilise.
Exactly. And it also unlocks things as well. So, for instance, we just take the Brixham Paralegics, for instance. We had, I think, 14 before lockdown. I think we've got about 3 or 4 left now. But actually, they supplied the rope industry just over the border in Dorset, in Bridport, which is a Gundry town. So they were making the ropes for the fishing. So that's a business line which is completely gone because the paperwork is too difficult to do. And it's those sort of little things where actually the knock-on effects, the domino effects on the supply chain and how the environment works around businesses is quite difficult to make sure you don't hurt something in the process. So I just think we just need to keep it really, really simple. Planning laws, of course, is the other one for construction and for anything to do with transportation. Just trying to get anything off the ground in terms of working through planning is a major issue. And it's one area where I sort of rub my hands and go, that needs a dose of AI, because if everything was actually recorded on digital twins and places like that, you'd be able to do things very much more quickly and model out the consequences. But that's a huge step forward. But it would be, if you look at cities which are using it, like in Korea, actually they're 14, 15 years ahead of us in terms of town planning because they've already made those changes.
Meanwhile, over here, if you want to make a change, you're going to go and find the scroll.
Absolutely.
Which has the blueprint somewhere in a town hall basement. Yeah. You're clearly at one with tech. Mm. You love technology. From one to another, I hope you don't mind me saying you're a geek. Do you like that term? Or do you not like that
term? Yeah, I do, but I have a rule.
Go on then.
So there's a contrary piece of this.
Okay.
If something doesn't work in 16 seconds, forget it, right?
Oh, I love that.
So what the net result in the chamber is, if something's not working in a piece of tech, as far as I'm concerned, I'm done. Someone else fixes it, right? Because that's not me. I've spent my entire career focusing on customer experience is the reason that you really differentiate in a business. So from my perspective, a piece of tech that doesn't work is bin. And while I'm quite happy to build it for you, I'm quite happy to code it for you. If it doesn't work, forget it.
Yeah.
Okay, so 16 seconds, that's it. And poor old Ronnie has been picking up after me where I've gone, that doesn't work, that doesn't work. What's in here? No, I don't like that. Right, let's change it. And that's just simply because tech is there to serve us. It's to make our lives easier. It augments our intelligence. It gives us time to do other things. It should just make life easier. And if it's not making life easier, then put it in the dustbin, recycle it.
So what's the next 12 months look like for you then? Apart from getting rid of everything that doesn't work within 16 seconds, which, I mean, there's not going to be much left, actually, if you apply that rule to everything.
Just to technology.
Yeah.
To technology.
The first 12 months.
So we've done a piece of work on our five pillars, our strategy, which we're launching on the 22nd of January up at Newton Abbott to all our members. And that's really to set out a stall about the things that we think will help businesses and to get feedback on that. We're also developing alongside that what I'd call the lenses for the 14 vertical segments, so we can make sure that each segment has a plan against it. And then we can take that forward against our place boards. So we have a place board in Plymouth and one in Exeter. We're hopefully going to have one in Torbay and probably one in the north very shortly. And that means that we can then associate that with the fact that Devon is a diverse county.
And quite a big one.
And a very big one, third largest geographical county in the UK. And then we can pull that together to make sure that we're feeding into BCC. So, for instance, when the 70 accredited chambers for overseas are in the UK, we've got enough knowledge to know which ones need to come here and we need to talk to, because actually there's the opportunity for inward investment or for export opportunity and how we make those work. If we need things lobbied or advocated for, making sure that we're getting those on those lists. So the whole idea is to really build on our membership and support them in the best ways that we can. And we're not going to change any of the networking stuff we do because we all love it. It means we get a chance to be sociable. But we're building another layer now on top, which is all about, right, where are we going with this? What do we need to change? So just a little snippet. An example of one of those pillars is Digital Devon, as you would expect from someone like me, which is we've got so much talent down here. Torbay is a really great cluster for photonics. We've got loads of stuff going on with AI in Plymouth itself. The two universities completely outperform where they should be in terms of their technical capability. We should be promoting Digital Devon because actually it's a really good place to come and work if you're in digital. So it's things like that, making sure everybody has the skills, has the capability. If we need to go and get investment, if we need to go and get systems, what do we need? And then working with everyone to bring that together.
Crumbs, you've got a busy 12 months ahead of you.
A fun 12 months.
Fun 12 months, your next chapter. Away from the boardroom, I've got a list of hobbies here. It says you're an equestrian, which is horses.
Yes.
A hiker, a musician, a singer. Mm. I never had you down as a singer.
Yeah.
Owner of a dog, some donkeys.
I learned to ride before I went to school. I'm horse mad. I've been horse mad all my life. This is the first time I've been without horses for a while. The donkeys were basically the accompaniment to the horses, because horses get bit lonely. So I have two donkeys who are friendship donkeys, but unfortunately horses live about 23, 24 years and donkeys live 50. So,
do they really?
Yeah, and I had them when they were babies.
Word.
Yeah, so I have to make provision in my will because they'll probably outlive me. So they're quite little personalities. So that's why I've still got donkeys. I'm between horses at the moment. And that was been, you know, from childhood onwards. I just find it really relaxing to go for a gallop. It's just one of those things. And it, also, I like working with the animal. It just is a really comfortable relationship. And the dog just builds on that because actually, to be honest with you, my last dog used to quite often, if we're going up a hill, jump on the saddle and have a ride up the hill with me rather than walk. Oh. So, you know, it was lovely. So you'd have a pair of dog ears here and you'd be riding up the hill with a dog. So yeah, it's just an outside life. And I love that. And, you know, if you grew up in the Southwest, people always say, well, what did you do? And the answer was, I ran riot. I had a fantastic time. I used to swim in the sea. We used to explore. And most of it was done on horseback, you know, with my mates. And I absolutely loved it. And you don't leave that behind just because you move area. And when I've come back, we are so lucky where we live. It is just beautiful. Our beaches, our countryside, our cities are interesting. What more could you ask for?
So, oh, absolutely. You know, I agree more. Yeah.
So out and about, enjoying that as much as I can.
Fantastic. So finally, you're going to be taking over here.
Yes.
You're going to be sat this side of the desk.
Yes.
interviewing people, hopefully with the new series of In Conversation With. Have you done anything like this before? I think you've got an AI podcast or something, or you've been a guest on an AI podcast.
Yes.
What are you looking forward to? What's your approach going to be?
I think conversations are much better when they're relaxed like this. And it's finding out about people and what makes them tick, what they think's important, learning from them, learning what their businesses do, learning about themselves and sharing that with the rest of the wider membership. I think that's a really great thing to do. Pick up on some of those trends and discuss them and see where we're going. We don't all go to the pub like we used to, but those were the conversations you'd have had at the end of the day, standing on the bar, chatting. Yeah. Isn't it great? We can do it with technology now and all chat together as and when we can.
Excellent. Well, I wish you the very best of luck. I'm sure it'll be compelling listening. I don't know whether you're going to stick to the studio or get some wellies and do it remotely in the middle of Dartmoor with this, right? Oh, that'll give the production team something to think about. So if you had to choose an afternoon on horseback, a long walk in the hills or pick up a saxophone, which one would you choose in order to switch off?
Oh, every time the horse. Yeah.
Nay.
Yeah.
My word. I'll go and get my bundle of hay and leave right now. Helen Wild Archibald, thank you very much for joining us in Conversation With. And congratulations once again on your new role. And all the best for taking up the headphones.
Thank you very much indeed.
In Conversation With is supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Helping with all your business and personal taxation needs. Westcott's, we're here. Produced by Fresh Air Studios. Full audio and video production services for business podcasts and corporate events. Visit freshairstudios.com. Produced by Paul Philpott. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess Moon. Video production by Mark Stevenson. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Copyright Devon Chamber and Fresh Air Studios Limited. All rights reserved.